3RPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 11.
Out of the Education Department. Up to the time I entered upon my duties as a teacher for the State Department, my health had been excellent for nearly 20 years. In fact, I had not consulted a medical man for many years until I faced the examination in connection with my appointment. My first year in this position ended with the death of my mother after a long illness. And although I was sad and worn, the Christmas vacation followed and gave me the chance to recover and prepare myself for the renewed strain. My work always brought much satisfaction to my mind, but the unrelenting opposition to which I was subjected began to tell, as I carried on year after year. It would require a tough body to withstand the intensity of emotion so often engendered in the struggle. Perhaps the greatest harm was done by the constant suppression of feeling, which I found inevitable to preserve the peace with the management of the institution. By degrees, I felt my energy waning, till the year when the pneumonic influenza shook our community to the roots, when I had a serious illness lasting 10 weeks. I got back to work after that period of leave, and thought I was my old self again. A year or two later, we had some sickness in the school, and I contracted some infection, which was diagnosed as cardiac influenza, and held me chained for another long period. My wrath at being laid aside was as bad as the deadly sickness. Yet once again I got back and went on with my job. In spite of these breaks, my reports from various inspectors show that teaching at least I was still fit, though at times I was so tired at the end of the day that I went to bed soon after reaching home. Then the Christmas holidays at the end of my 12th year approached. The annual examinations had to be gone through, and the breaking up and all the fuss of the season. The last day came, and we were busy packing away all the appliances, filling the last requests of the pupils who wished to borrow slates and books with which to amuse themselves in the vacation. Margaret Stewart, one of my girls, was very enthusiastic over arithmetic, and she had asked me to show her the method of finding square and cube root, as she planned to have a revel in these problems while absent from classes. I went to her desk, and was standing by to show her the pattern of the sum, when suddenly the world vanished. When I came to my senses, I was on a couch brought in from the playroom, and Matron Briggs and Miss Brown, the lady assistant, were attending to me. I had fallen with my temple on the corner of the desk, but I soon recovered enough to walk out to a taxi, which had been called, and was delivered at my home and into the care of Miss Lawson. At first I supposed it had been merely a fainting fit, and as I had taken place for myself and Miss Lawson at a holiday resort for most of January, I expected to be quite restored by the time school opened. But before setting off, severe debility sent me to a doctor, who told me I had had a slight stroke and must go to bed for at least 6 weeks. At first, I scarcely realized the significance of the blow. I cancelled my holiday booking, retired to my couch, and tried to think, although my brain was definitely hazy for some weeks. One idea got possession of me. I could never go back to my school again, and it would be a solution if the stroke were repeated and proved fatal. How thankful I could be if my vexations, struggles, and mental misery were over for good. For weeks I lay, gradually recovering. It was not my will to do so, but just the inherent strength of my constitution that had come to me from my mother. The recovery was only partial, and month after month I waited for returning health. The most distressing symptom was a persistent pain at the bottom of the spine, thought by the doctors to be a reflex from the cerebral condition, and I lay here on the sofa, trying a rest cure recommended by a specialist called in. I had quite forgotten that about 3 weeks before school closed, I had had a fall through a sliding chair passing under me. Later, after a year and a half, the X-ray revealed that I had injured the lower part of the spine. The long story of this part of my illness need not be told. Suffice it to say that the surgeon ultimately removed the injured bone and gave me back a good many happy and useful years, though not my power to stand up to a job like regular teaching. It took me some years to get out the house again, but the blessed event came at last. Meanwhile, considerations of income began to oppress me in my sickness. I continued to apply for sick leave, but after the regulation 3 weeks on full pay and 3 on half pay, the leave was granted without any pay at all. Before the breakdown came, I had managed to complete the payments to the bank for my cottage, so I had a home rent-free. Also, I had saved a little money, which soon melted away in housekeeping and medical expenses and maintenance. At last, I was about at the end of my resources and must soon face the necessity of accepting a refuge with my relatives. Let me say here that they did not fail me and would have taken me gladly, but for so many years I had been building my nest, and in it I had found such happiness and peace that to give it up was the most dreadful item in the list of my calamities. Then came my friends of the Association for the Advancement of the Blind, an organization I had founded and led for years, urging me to accept financial help from that source. I could not do it. It was not exactly petty pride which stepped in, but a strong repulsion to using funds for my own benefit which had been collected, or countenanced at any rate, by half a lifetime of service to others. Most of my friends could not understand my attitude in the matter, but it was not the way. Afterwards, my fellow blind helped to sell a book for me, and in that way relieved my position considerably. The story is told elsewhere in detail. In the days prior to my appointment as a teacher, I had been intimate with the family of Mr. James Martin of the Australian Steelworks, and that friendship had been continued through the years of my connection with the Education Department. As my illness lingered on, Mrs. Martin was often on the spot with her kind, motherly personality, and she grew more and more anxious for me as she realized that my employment was gone for good, and that my home seemed likely to go the same way. She and her children, especially Nellie, a gifted businesswoman and known as the Steel Queen, offered to stand by me and see what could be done to solve my problems. They were anxious to save me humiliation, and Mrs. Martin, in proposing a plan, pleaded that I had always professed to trust in God. But the Father of us all did not rain down pound notes from the clouds, preferring to use his willing children to deliver them when necessary. I found it hard to yield, yet did so when Nell quietly invited a few well-to-do friends to supply my needs. If these lines should come to the knowledge of any of that small group, let them be assured that their tender mercies are not forgotten. They kept me in my home, the best place for me, as I have always conceived it, and here I have spent about 20 of my most useful and contented years. It must be remembered that at the date of my breakdown, there was no superannuation scheme for state servants on the statute books. As months passed, and it became certain that I could never resume my position, there floated in a vague rumour that such a scheme was under consideration. I was advised by a wise counsellor not to retire officially, but to go on applying for sick leave without pay until my department refused to grant it any longer. This I did, and the game lasted for a year. Then a superannuation bill went through the State Parliament, and I was thankful to learn that I was in a small group that would receive pension benefits without contribution. I sent in my resignation, asking for permission to retire, and for the pension made available by the Act. The matter took many months to finalise, for there was some hitch about letters which, it was stated, I had not answered, but which actually I had not even received. So in due time I was provided with a pension of £2 a week, and resolved to live on it. However meagre it proved, and to relinquish the help coming from my friends as soon as I could free myself of medical costs. The prospect of this regular income, always hoped for, had made it easier for me to live on benevolent friends for a time. Then, as my superannuation money settled in, some withdrew their help, but not all, for at least a year or two, as it was desired that I should have complete ease of mind until my health was restored. As for the school, it long remained a nightmare. I would awake in the morning with its shadow upon my spirit. Then my mind would clear as I remembered that I would thank God that I had been resting peacefully under my own roof, and would not be obliged to go out again into the stress which I had found so crushing. Only one more incident of that period of my life is left to tell. One day, perhaps 15 months after I had been brought home ill, I had a visit from the matron and the superintendent. They came with messages of appreciation from the committee, saying that I had been an outstanding teacher and an inspiration to the children, and that the one way in which this appreciation could be shown was by making me a life governor of the institution, and forthwith the certificate was presented. I could not control myself. I broke down, weeping. I was still a sick woman with a major surgical operation just ahead, and the long-deferred recognition of my work seemed to me rather a tragic affair. I shall not write down my thoughts in that hour, but they overwhelmed me in my weakness. This was the final scene in my connection with the education department. And so, exit Tilly Aston, the school teacher. And another of Tilly's poems. I had an enemy. I had an enemy, but now the last soft-fingered visitant has come and passed, dissolved his body in the earth's grey dust, his treasures soon to yield to moth and rust. 'Twas not the substance which I failed to love, that hides the spirit as the hand a glove. It was the living soul that faithless fled, leaving me yearning fondness cold and dead. While he was living, fear was ever nigh, lest he again should rudely thrust me by, lest darts of disagreement pierce my soul, pushing us from each as pole from pole. But now his stabs and stings I fear no more. His tongue has lost its power to wound me sore, and e'en the memory of those bitter hours shall be cast out as other withered flowers. For he, mine enemy, dwells in the light, where no misunderstanding dims the sight. He knows how fervent was my heart's intent. So fearless, I forgive and am content. Making a home. Some earlier reference to my beloved home will have given the impression that this interest in my life was one of the dearest. For 20 years after the completion of my formal education, I had lived contentedly with my brother Stephen, where mother presided nominally, and where I gradually assumed the cares and duties of housekeeping. As time progressed, some of the young people of our family drifted to Melbourne from the country in search of a settlement in life, and it was our part to take them into the home as boarders and help them through. So it became necessary to have some help, and Anne, my eldest sister's daughter, stepped in to fill the gap. She was still with us when I got my appointment, and for a time held the fort as mother's end approached. That particular year was one of great trial for me. The conditions at school were harassing, and at home our dear one was enduring the bitter suffering which tortures those who die of cancer in the stomach. At the last, Anne's mother came from the country and sent her daughter back to the less trying task there. In December, our dear invalid passed on, and we took her remains to Carisbrook to be laid beside those of our father in the quiet graveyard among its rustling trees. It now seemed advisable that I should secure a home for myself sooner or later. My brother had a bride in view, and my nieces, Lottie and Carrie, both in the telephone service, would need a place to board when this marriage should take place. Of course, neither Steve nor his prospective wife were willing for me to go. In fact, my decision to break away caused a temporary coolness among us. But I had practically run the house at Mooney Ponds for years, and realized that I might be tempted to try the same thing with sister-in-law, who had every right to be supreme in her husband's ménage. Therefore, I determined to make the wrench once, and at the beginning, and not risk mistakes or heartaches later. Lottie and Carrie agreed to come with me if I got a house, and Anne would look after the three of us until her own marriage, which was to take place a few months later. The train journey to my work from Moonee Ponds had been an added hardship, and for this reason I sought a house in the neighbourhood of the Royal Victorian Institute for the Blind. In those days it was not difficult to find a cottage for sale, especially if the purchaser were not bent on a place of modern type. The wooden structure at 42 Raleigh Street, Windsor, still my abiding place, came onto the market just then, and I bought it, mostly with money borrowed from the credit foncier, which I was able to pay off in about 7 years. It should be remembered, however, that in earlier years I had contrived to buy a small property in Ascot Vale, and this gave me ample security for the purchase of this one. I had hoped to have this as an asset, but as time went on, it proved unprofitable, so I sold it, and paid off the one in Windsor during the First World War. It was a fortunate chance for me that I owned my house when my health collapsed. Otherwise, I should not have been able to hold on here while the accidents of life adjusted themselves. I came to live in Windsor in September 1914, and my brother was married very soon after. We had gay times settling in, buying furniture and fittings as fast as money became available. One week it would be a table cover, the next a carving set. The sitting room was repapered by the lovers of my boarders, and I assure you the operation was long drawn out and provided many extra occasions for visiting here. I had been accumulating household linen and was well stocked in that line, yet the gaps had to be filled. The fun of making a home is not to be despised, and I sometimes wonder what pleasure is left for the bride who can start out equipped with even the smallest item for housekeeping. The dainty extras were a long time coming. Indeed, they are not all in hand yet. I wanted a place of rest and comfort from which I should wish to hasten back from even the rosiest of scenes, to which my friends could resort for quiet intercourse, and where could come the members of the clan, feeling they were part of it. In this house of mine I have not had luxury and elegance, which wealth alone could buy. Nevertheless, it is a home, a place where we can chat and eat and drink tea, and where men friends can have a whiff of their favourite weed without reproach or trepidation. Warmth, too, is here, the glow of fire in winter, and the nestle of rugs and cushions. Truly, I think I have a right to call it a home. The first perplexity I had to face was the finding of a new housekeeper to replace Anne, who went up country to marry a farmer near her father's place in the January, after our removal to Windsor. I had been warned that this would be my problem, that I might have to contend with drinking women or thieves or with incompetence or extravagance. It was with some nervousness I sent an advertisement to the Methodist paper, The Spectator, hoping thus to escape the bibulous and the dishonest, if not the muddler. Many answers arrived, and I selected two as a first trial. The first was a young lady willing to come into my home for a few months until one should be ready for the bridal day. But she wanted much time off, liberty unlimited for the faithful swain to hang around, and no end of privileges. I desired someone likely to be permanent, so turned to my second choice. I sent for Miss Mary Lawson, a middle-aged woman, not long out from the north of England. The moment I spoke to her, I knew she was mine. She took over my small establishment and stayed with me till her death, 16 years later. It will be readily understood that in this position, a person of capability and refinement would be desirable, for I must live alone with her most of the time, trust her with my business, and leave her to do her work in her own way. I at once perceived that the most comfortable relation to be attained between servant and employer is to get the right subordinate and then leave her to make the best of the job. This principle I have followed, and by so doing I won for both sides peace of mind and perfect confidence in each other. I tried never to forget that each of us had individuality, which must be given play. Each had friends to cultivate and small interests to pursue apart from the other. Thus we lived together through 16 years, more harmoniously than often happens with sisters. Her friends became mine, and some still keep in touch with me, though it is 14 years since Miss Lawson died. To be explicit, we learnt to love one another, and her exit from this world is one of the sharpest griefs I've ever had to bear. Her illness, once more the dreaded cancer, began to manifest itself a year after I gave up teaching. Miss Lawson had stood by me through the lingering disability of that year, and after much thought, I decided that if possible, she should stay here, for she had no one to whom she might turn in an emergency. By degrees, matters worsened, and we had to seek for additional help in the home. For nearly 12 months, I had a taste of the woes of the servant question, of many changes and losses of money through inefficiency and the rest. Then it was found necessary to operate on Miss Lawson, and at about the same time the injury to my back was discovered, and I too had to face the surgeon. I do not like to think of those months. My operation over, but still bedfast for many weeks, Miss Lawson going through her ordeal while I lay helpless. It was indeed a cyclone of troubles, and I hardly know how I survived the worry. Friends were so loving and thoughtful, and did much to soften the blows for both of us. At that time also my dear guardian friend died, Miss Nellie Martin. She had always been so strong and wise, giving me a sense of security and the certainty that my difficulties would be solved. She had for some years been managing the Australia Steelworks, her late father's business, and was a woman of unusual force and ability. She too was smitten with cancer and died at the age of 39, and thus was lost to the community one of the most outstanding citizens of her day. As both Miss Lawson and I slowly got onto our feet, the dark deluge subsided and hope bloomed once more. Yet it was apparent that never again would my home affairs go forward in the old smooth fashion instituted by my dear helper. I tried charwomen and other forms of aid, but none were successful. At last, Miss Ada Bradford was mentioned to me as a likely companion, and I got in touch with her, only to fall in love a second time with a dear good woman. She came to me, willing to face the almost inevitable task of caring for Miss Lawson, through her last agonies. And she is still with me after more than 16 years as my homemaker, nurse, companion, and friend. To have had two such women in my home is a gift of God, for which I never cease to give him thanks. Miss Lawson was a businesswoman, cheerful and kind with my friends, rich and poor, and endowed with unusual personal charm. My present companion, Miss Bradford, has all the charm and daintiness, and best of all, a personal devotion equal to that of a sister. In my accumulating years, her perennial youth is very refreshing, and life would be dull without her. One by one, the whole of my immediate family has passed the bourne, and it is fortunate that I have someone capable of filling the empty place. Miss Lawson died in October 1930, and stayed with us to the end. Miss Bradford cared for us both, save that we had a nurse to relieve the last heavy months, paid for with Miss Lawson's savings during her long service with me. I was thus spared the horror of having to send the poor invalid away to die in a hospital. Miss Bradford and I, both carrying along with us precious memories of that sweet English woman, whose days, while she lived with me, abounded in love and wisdom and gratitude. And another poem from Tilly. My old house. The house that I loved is growing old. Its beams are blemished with a secret mould. The rigid walls their symmetry no more maintain, and slopes the level of the floor. Each window rattles in its shrunken frame, and in the winter nights the dancing flame upon the hearth betokens drifts of air that thrust their icy fingers everywhere. Unwilling latches slip their stubborn hold, the sagging doors upon their hinges scold. Ah, yes, alas, my house is aging fast, the glory of its prime is overcast. Yet still I strive with hammer, saw, and nail, with here a patch and there a strong new rail, with paintbrush dipped in smiling colours gay, the wasting touch of time to hold at bay. For in this house I claim the sacred right to sit apart, communing with the light that burns within me, kindling love supreme that moulds in deeds my aspiration's dream. Here I can pray and tune my soul anew to everlasting truths, and here construe the little lessons of this life of ours, its losing weakness and its winning powers. And here a friend may find my willing ear, unfolding joys or mourning sorrows drear, for peace and comfort claim this lowly spot, since I am mistress in this ancient cot. However aged and grey the walls may grow, though pulsing life may ever run more slow, it still is home, the place where I am free, the temple where God shows himself to me.
And that brings us to the end of episode 11 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pam Adams. This series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.